This is Director Chris Rodriguez of the New Jersey Office of Homeland Security and Preparedness, and I want to welcome you to Season 2 of Intelligence Unclassified. This season, we are refocusing our episodes to better reflect NJOHSP's three core mission areas: counterterrorism, cybersecurity, and emergency preparedness. We'll be pulling both local and national experts in all these fields in an effort to discuss New Jersey's diverse threat landscape and to offer you a unique perspective on current homeland security trends and issues. If this is your first time listening, then thanks for coming. Please feel free to add this podcast to your RSS feed or iTunes. You can also follow us on Twitter at NJOHSP and Facebook. All links can be found in the show notes and on our website, www.njhomelandsecurity.gov.
Hello, Intelligence Unclassified listeners. My name is Angie Gadd. Thanks for tuning in. I'm joined today with Amarnath Amarsingham, a senior research fellow at the Institute for Strategic Dialogue, a fellow at George Washington University's Program on Extremism, and he also co-directs the study of Western foreign fighters based at the University of Waterloo. Amarnath has done some excellent work. He's interviewed over 40 jihadists and foreign fighters. Amar, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So to start off, Amar, you recently co-authored an article called Talking to Foreign Fighters, Insights into the Motivations for Hijra to Syria and Iraq. You state that almost all of your sample size of the 20 foreign fighters that you interviewed, essentially they dwelled on the significance of a youthful turn to religion, you know, to explain their process of radicalization and subsequently how they became foreign fighters or why they chose to become foreign fighters. And then you stated that this often occurred without much prompting on their end, on your end. So why do you think that is? Is that an attempt by them to proactively or subconsciously justify their actions or reasoning for their reasonings to become foreign fighters under the cloak of religion to attempt to prove something?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. I think on the one hand, almost everyone we've spoken with and has gone through some kind of, I would say, you know, for lack of a better term, a born again experience sometime in their youth, whether they're born Muslim but weren't really practicing for most of their life, or whether they're converts from a Christian background or something like that, or a Buddhist background or whatever have you. I think everyone went through a kind of conversion experience which was deeply significant for them. And which eventually got them down the path to thinking about jihad and thinking about traveling to a theater of conflict to contribute somehow. I think the kind of emphasis on that side of it, or the focus on religion, shouldn't easily be dismissed. I think analysts often say, oh yeah, of course these guys are going to talk about religion, but what's really at stake, right? What's really the motivating factor? And I think we need to not always rush to do that and actually listen to what they have to say. If they're talking about religion for most of the time that you're talking to them, maybe it is actually important to them. And so to easily dismiss it as propaganda or something like that, I don't think is worthwhile, because we generally wouldn't dismiss anything else that they say as simple propaganda, whether they're talking about family upbringing or their socioeconomic background or their ethnic identity or their refugee experience. We would kind of listen to what they have to say. So I think generally, when people talk about religion, we kind of dismiss it, and so we should probably stop doing that so often or so quickly. And so that was kind of the underlying argument behind that article that we published. I mean, having said that, I think there is an element of the difference between kind of propaganda and the way they talk about religion, I think, is important, because it's not simply you know, them kind of waxing poetic about their motivations. It's more about their religious upbringing, what caused the conversion, what led to their conversion, or what led to them start to think about jihad, and when they became politicized, and when their religious identity became politicized, and all those kinds of questions. And so I think those did take a little bit of prodding, but what didn't take prodding was this kind of more propaganda side of it, which I think most people are accustomed to hearing just from watching ISIS videos or anything like that. And so I think we do need to draw a distinction between the propaganda side of their religion and them talking about their religious upbringing or their religious identity.
It's interesting, as you were saying that, occurred to me that for me, actually, when I ask that question or when I start questioning the authenticity of their religious claims, it's more so not questioning or speculating that it has any propaganda nexus, but more so I look at it from the aspect of the Muslim community and how, you know, groups like Al-Qaeda and ISIS and the foreign fighters, et cetera, that you interview, the way that they dismiss moderate Muslims as not true Muslims, and they dismiss those individuals as being religious. So I always look at it from two sides, as, well, they're dismissing the religiosity of the moderate Muslim community, and the moderate Muslim community is dismissing the religiosity or the religious claims of the extremists as well. So I kind of look at it in that sense. The issue for me is just questioning, I don't know if we'll ever be able to get an answer for this, the authenticity of the religious claims and the religious drivers to become foreign fighters more so.
Yeah, I mean, it's a difficult question because it's kind of going to the heart of why people say anything and believe anything and hold any positions, which, you know, in the sociological literature and the psychology literature is what's known as the problem of accounts, right? Where people's accounting of their own life and their own beliefs is often skewed in some way. So if you talk, you know, if you interview someone while they're having made Hijra, having fought in Syria, they're more likely to depict all of their past life as a kind of build-up to that event. And just like if you talk to regular converts to any religion, or whether it be Christianity, you know, you talk to a new Christian, for example, and they'll kind of paint their past as somehow more troublesome than it probably was if you talk to their parents or friends. And somehow that kind of building up to eventually finding the truth and hearing the good news. And so there's always this problem of talking to people where their kind of sense of their past is always a build up to their present, or is always a golden age where their present is difficult. And so hearing people talk about that life or that version of themselves is often pretty difficult. But I don't think as researchers or as analysts we have any other choice, right? I mean, and it's important to talk to them, and it's important to talk to everyone around them, their families and their friends, to get a more holistic picture of what drives these individuals to make the choices that they do. In terms of their kind of dismissal of other religions, or other religious identities, I think that's quite important, because, you know, people often say, oh, it's not their religion, it's not a religious choice, it's that they've made new friends, or they've decided to hang out with a new set of people in their neighborhood, and that's what caused the radicalization. But you have to take a step back and say, well, what caused that split with their old friends and the adoption of their new friends? And it's often this sense that, oh, my immediate circle are no longer Muslim, or they're munafiqeen, or they're sellouts and people that shouldn't be listened to, and they've kind of sold out their Muslim identity and so on. And so even the adoption of new friends and even the adoption of a new social circle is often through the lens of their religious identity. And that goes for, you know, who they read, the imams they listen to, their friends, how they dress, and all of these kinds of things, right? And so we need to be careful of just kind of separating those two things as if they're not related, I think, because once people go through this kind of galvanizing revolutionary religious identity, I think that kind of impacts all the other aspects of their life, including deciding to dismiss vast amounts of everyday Muslims as not real Muslims and worthy sometimes being killed. And so that's kind of the problem. So.
It's very interesting. So among the fighters that you interviewed in your sample, they kind of kept harkening back to, we're doing this for the sake of Allah. In their perspective, wouldn't adhering to the five pillars of Islam suffice? And I know I say that, I know the answer would probably be that they want to take it a step further, but the interviews that you quoted in the article, you know, jihad is not among the five pillars of Islam. And I'd be interested in knowing if any of these individuals completed the actual required hijra or the pilgrimage to Mecca in Saudi Arabia.
Right. No, I don't think the majority of them went on Hajj or anything like that. For them, jihad is, I would say, the sixth pillar of Islam, right? They kind of elevate jihad to the utmost importance, particularly in the context of injustice and suffering of Muslims around the world. So, you know, a lot of them say in the context of Syria, you know, once you have an event like Syria with 500,000 people dead and millions of refugees, what is my obligation as a Muslim youth in the context of this, and how do I respond to this? And then they go back to people like Abdullah Azam, who says, you know, in this kind of context, jihad becomes that much more important, and it becomes a fundamental obligation of any able-bodied Muslim to do something. And so they actually elevate this idea of fighting back or doing something to a kind of pillar of Islam, a kind of requirement for them. Once you do that, a few other things also happen, which is quite interesting, in that they start to really downplay kind of the intellectual, theological side of religion in an interesting way, because for them, and a lot of people have said this, or a lot of fighters have told me this, where they say, you know, the time for talking is over, the time for action is here. In the context of this much injustice and suffering, it doesn't make sense to just sit around in kind of private halakas and debate about the underpinnings of religion and the theological debates. It's actually time to do something. And that's kind of what drives them to dismiss a lot of imams as well, where, you know, this idea that, oh, these foreign fighters don't really know anything about Islam, they're not really well-versed in Islam, that argument is often thrown at them, and they'll say, well, it's not really the time for learning, it's a time for fighting back in self-defense. If someone's breaking into your house, it's not the time to go do a literature review on home break-ins or robberies, right? It's a time to protect your family. For them, the emergency of it is, I think, very much tied to how they act and how they go about it and how they relate to what is required of their faith and required of themselves as Muslims.
Amar, so a couple of the foreign fighters that you interviewed, one of them stated that I like the idea of shahada, which is martyrdom in Islam, no accountability in the grave and on the day of judgment. And another fighter said, I can't go through punishment and questioning. I'm too scared of that. I have too many sins on the hands. And as I was reading them, it occurred to me, you know, I'm not sure if this is common among jihadists or foreign fighters that you've interviewed in general outside of the sample that you present in this article. And I see that as a way of them trying to atone for their past sins through martyrdom and essentially take the, what I'm interpreting as taking the easy way out rather than leading a pious life. Now, are they... And this may be, you know, too in the weeds. Do they want to be mujahideen and do they want to be suicide bombers and die because they want to atone for their sins, or do they want to do it because they see this as a duty that they have to fulfill?
Both, I would say. I think a lot of them, you know, particularly in Europe, do come from fairly criminal backgrounds, have had issues with drugs and violence and gangs. And so a lot of them do talk about their current jihad in the language of redemption, right? In the language of wiping the slate clean, because it's so much of a noble cause. It's so much of a thing to do that all of my past wrongs will be righted. And at the same time, a lot of them have mentioned, for example, this idea that you can intercede on judgment day for, you know, 70 or some odd of your family members. You know, initially I dismissed that as, oh, that's just something they say, but I've kind of found it remarkable when you talk to family members, for example, how many of them actually bring it up, because the family members will say, you know, we had his mom crying on the phone, we had his dad crying on the phone, his dad's been hospitalized from depression, he's left his wife behind, he's left his kids behind, and we kind of throw that all in his face when he calls from Syria and say, you know, how can you leave all this and go do your jihad? And he'll say, well, don't worry about it. I'll, you know, I can intercede for you guys when the time comes. And, you know, it's a short-term suffering for kind of long-term gain in the end. And it, you know, this world is temporary and the next world is forever and all of those kinds of things, right? Which we often dismiss as, oh, that's just propaganda. Of course they're going to talk that way about this world and the next world. But to tell your family that while they're, you know, suffering at home without you is something I think you need to take seriously, right? And it's a remarkable thing to say, I've left my wife and my five-year-old behind to go do this because in the end times I will, you know, they'll be okay. So they do actually interpret all of this in the language of redemption and the language of sacrifice, right? It's as if they're giving up something for the betterment of their family. And so it's a kind of what we would consider a kind of crazy thing, but I think you need to kind of get in their heads a little bit to fully kind of grasp it. And I think in the context of their worldview, whether it's, you know, Orthodox or not, or whether it's Islamic or not, in the context of their worldview, I think they see it as a fundamentally rational thing to do, as if I'm making a short-term sacrifice for a very long-term reward. And all of that is not simply theoretical for them or debatable for them. It's just kind of the way things are, and they kind of take it for granted. And so I think truly understanding the worldview, whether they've been holding it for a short time or whether they've been not really fully understanding all the other aspects of Islam and so on, I think it's kind of a remarkable thing in a weird way. So,
Circling back to your article, the entire premise of it centers around the drivers or the push and pull factors, as you stated, for these individuals to radicalize and make hijra to Syria. And you basically stated that these factors were not contingent on the limited economic chances of the foreign fighters. So you state in the article that you didn't explicitly ask foreign fighters about lack of prospects and purposely left your questions open-ended. Do you think that they didn't make any reference to their socioeconomic status as a precursor to radicalization so as not to really set themselves up as losers per se, and rather frame it within the cloak of religiosity to essentially boost their own image and make it seem like their reason and purpose was more religiously founded? Or does this go back to what you were stating earlier, that this is essentially how they actually perceive themselves as being religious, and in hindsight, your past is basically a whole buildup of your present state or your present status right now?
Yeah, I mean, it's a difficult one, because I kind of made a distinction between push factors and pull factors. And so the reason we do that is because the push factors tend to be all over the place. And, you know, there's a difference between the ones I've talked to, for example, and then the general kind of database of fighters that we have based on interviews with friends and family members, but not necessarily the family members of particular fighters and so on. And so they tend to come from all over in terms of socioeconomic background. But what does kind of tie them together, I think, is this broader search for meaning in life, which a lot of people say, but it's kind of also pretty generic, right? It kind of sounds like an explanation, but it's not. But the point is that, you know, that there are people who come from convert backgrounds, who've dropped out of high school, who've had drug addiction, mental health issues, who traveled to Syria. But then there's also several of these guys in Europe and North America who are, you know, pretty well educated, are actually making a lot of money, have $100,000 paying jobs, who are married with children, who also decide to leave. And so the trouble with the socioeconomic argument, particularly for Western fighters, is that they come from vastly different backgrounds, and it kind of clears things up a bit to say they come, you know, the drivers are more kind of perceived grievances or perceived lack of opportunity or perceived sense of lack of meaning and those kinds of things, to say, you know, I lived this life. You know, one of these guys from Calgary in Canada, for example, told his friends, you know, I'm from a traditional, you know, immigrant family perspective, I've kind of made it, right? I work at an energy company. I make a lot of money. I'm married with children. But while I'm here, I'm still left with this kind of gnawing sense of, what is it all for? What's the point of me being here? I've reached what other people have defined as success, but I still feel kind of empty inside, and I don't know what else to do. And a couple of years later, he flies off to Iraq and blows himself up, right? And so you're kind of left wondering, what is the actual driver there? Is it a kind of material sense, or is it something much deeper than that, to say, yeah, I've achieved what other people call success, but it's still kind of not enough in terms of what I really want? And of course, jihadists aren't the only ones who go through this kind of self-doubt and questioning. So the problem is, you know, people come from poor backgrounds, rich backgrounds, and they still kind of have these drivers. And so is it an explanation in itself? Not really. I think if you look at fighters in Syria and Iraq, in a comparative sense, these socioeconomic factors are much more prevalent. There's been some interesting interviews with defectors where they say, you know, I basically was in a neighborhood where ISIS took over, and they were the only employers, basically, and I had no other choice. Or, you know, they were paying more than another group, and so I had to join, and so on. So I think local fighters, you know, there might be something there in terms of how socioeconomic factors are explanatory. But for someone to leave the West, to leave England or the U.S. to go to Syria, to say that they're doing that for money doesn't make much sense, I think. But in terms of, you know, their family backgrounds, I think all of it needs to be taken into account holistically, because they do come from sometimes troubled backgrounds in terms of not getting along with their fathers, not getting along with their family members, mental health issues, general kind of loneliness, which is hard to quantify in any real research sense. You know, they'll tell you that I never really had any friends, I never really had a girlfriend, and those kinds of things. Which are they drivers? Well, I don't know, right? It's hard to kind of pinpoint something like that and say, oh, you left because you were lonely. Well, that doesn't, again, make much sense. So it's not an easy question to answer in terms of the push factors, but this is why I think the focus on pull factors to say that, you know, you're kind of driving towards something, not just fleeing from something, is an important distinction to make.
Really good insights. Thanks, Omar. I kind of want to switch to the European foreign fighters and the travelers and the non-travelers that ascribe to Salafi jihadist ideology. And I really wanted to ask about the distinction between them. So you did mention this during the podcast right now. Don't think it was in the report, but I'm referring here, and I read a recent report by the ICSR about criminal pasts, terrorist futures, European jihadists, and the new crime-terror nexus. And essentially, this is nothing new, right? I think many people are aware of how many jihadists or foreign fighters come from a criminal background or were involved in some criminal networks of some sort, especially those coming from Europe. Was there any distinct difference between jihadists that decide not to travel and the ones who do become foreign fighters, or the ones that are staying back home in Europe? Are they more entrenched in these criminal networks? Are we seeing some within those criminal networks also kind of follow a gradual progression and become foreign fighters and travel overseas? Were there any mentions from the individuals that you interviewed about their criminal pasts at all? Sorry, I just threw like three questions at you.
These are all good questions. I think the data in Europe suggests that link a little bit more strongly, I think, than North America, at least the stuff I've seen. But I think, yeah, I mean, again, the idea of the networks is important, because I think in Europe, particularly where you can just kind of drive to Syria, the kind of fluidity between individuals who stay behind, individuals who leave, individuals who organize for local attacks, fundraising, all those things are a bit more entrenched and a bit more robust, I think, than other parts of the world. And so I think those criminal networks, you know, there was a article by Rukmini from the New York Times who said, once new fighters arrive, they basically say, you know, what are your networks back home, right? And what can they do for us from over there? Which is typical kind of rebel movement, militant movement activity from as far back as the, you know, as far as we can remember, where all of these groups who want a kind of global footprint, of course, want to tap into networks back home. You know, whether you're talking about the Tamil Tigers in Sri Lanka or jihadist movements, they want to say, okay, well, you're here, but what networks do you have that can help us in terms of fundraising or sending us weapons? Or even lobbying on behalf of your local governments for some kind of activity and so on. And so I think whatever networks those are quite important. Whether the criminal networks add an added element to what jihadists are after particularly, I don't think there's enough research on that in terms of how these networks are actually functioning and what they're producing. So I think we'll have to see.
The sample of the fighters that you interviewed come from a number of different groups, including ISIS, Jabhat al-Nusra, or now Jabhat Fath al-Sham, Ahrar al-Sham, and some other groups as well. I was curious to know, I think many people believe that ISIS tends to kind of just take in any recruits. It doesn't have a vetting process per se. And the question here is really, does Nusra, or Jabhat Fath al-Sham rather, do they have a higher quality of recruits or stricter requirements when it comes to accepting fighters than ISIS does? Did you glean any of that off of the foreign fighters that you've interviewed in the past?
I think it's changing over time. So I think initially ISIS did have its doors wide open, and you did have to show some kind of linkages to somebody inside the movement to join. I don't know how much that's present anymore. With Nusra, I think the same kind of vetting process existed. They were much less interested in, for example, families coming over and women coming over, and they were more focused on these fighters and the vetting process. And I think in terms of how it's playing out, I think it's fairly similar. But how it's changing over time is difficult to say. But in general, the kind of quality of the foreign fighters I've noticed are quite different. The Nusra fighters, or JFS or Tahrir al-Sham, as they're now called, tend to be smarter, tend to know more about Islam, tend to be less kind of ideologically radical in a way. Because I mean, for them, it's still they still kind of talk about Assad and getting rid of Assad and the local goals that they're after. Whereas a lot of the ISIS fighters barely mention Assad anymore. I think they're much more interested in the caliphate and expanding the caliphate and all that. And that's some people have argued, that's Nusra's kind of long game, right? They of course are mentioning Assad and talking about the Syrian context because they want to entrench themselves further in the revolution and entrench themselves further in local movement to win hearts and minds, which has always been Al Qaeda's kind of thing. But in terms of the Western fighters, I have noticed that there tend to be a little bit more willing to talk, tend to be more polite, tend to be less kind of ideologically crazy, I guess, for the lack of a better term, and a bit more mature in their approach to things. And a little bit more well-trained in a bizarre way. And so I think there are some ISIS fighters who show up and are trained for, 2 weeks and then sent out. Whereas Nusra, I think, takes a bit more care with its fighters in terms of how they're prepped for battle and all of that. And there is a bit of Sharia training, just like with both groups. And a lot of Sharia training for Nusra has to do with why we're not ISIS, right? Or why ISIS sucks. And a lot of the kind of training for ISIS is a bit more about the caliphate and all of that. And so I think there are differences in terms of how people are prepped and brought into the movement and then trained and sent out. But of course, there are much less Western fighters with Nusra than anybody else. And so that's also a kind of component of it.
So I'm going to switch topics now to individuals here in the United States. So going back to 2015, there was an attack in Garland, Texas, targeting the Draw Muhammad contest. And Elton Simpson was one of the attackers. So Simpson was very active online. He was part of an online community of ISIS supporters. I recently heard you speak at a conference, and I remember you talked about this. I was really interested, wanted listeners to hear what happened among that online community of ISIS supporters after Simpson was killed.
Yeah, I mean, this is very interesting because for a select group of individuals who were very close to Simpson, his death, or what they called a kind of swindling of Simpson to kind of launch this attack, really kind of changed their minds about the movement, right? Or changed their minds about ISIS and whether it required their support or was worthy of their support. And they would say to take someone like Simpson, who was their friend online, not someone they'd actually met in real life, but talked to online, were very close to online, were considered as friends online, to use someone like him to launch an attack like this, which eventually got him killed, showed the kind of sloppiness of their recruiting process, showed the sloppiness of this, what people now call the remote controlled attacks, his interaction with Junaid Hussein, the British jihadist, hacker turned jihadist or hacking jihadist. It showed the kind of sloppiness of all of that and how dispensable any particular life was. And so this had a huge impact in that community of his friends to say, we're not really going to support this movement anymore because they're not really taking care of us, or they don't really care, and they don't really care about people. And so it's not like a lot of these supporters left jihadism as a whole, but some of them doubled down their support for Jabhat al-Nusra and other rebel movements and kind of got reestablished, I guess, in the original revolutionary spirit of what was happening in Syria with the rebel groups. And so the killing of Simpson, or killing of someone they called their friend, had a kind of strange ripple effect that I wasn't really anticipating, because I was expecting, all this celebration of, oh, he's a martyr, blah, blah, blah. Some of that did happen, of course, but I think the kind of emotional impact of someone like him dying, who many people cared about online, was quite surprising.
Yeah, this story is really interesting to me when I heard you speak about it, because just like you expect after someone conducts an attack, everyone would applaud them and, kind of try to follow in their footsteps. So when you were when you were saying that, it was more of like an ad hoc anti-ISIS campaign that just kind of ended up happening on its own. I thought that was very unexpected. I never thought that would ever happen. So lastly, I always look forward to reading your pieces when you release them, and the interviews that you conduct with jihadists and foreign fighters. Are there any upcoming interviews that you have in line that we should be expecting in the near future?
I'm hoping so. You know, this article that we put out only contains analysis of 20 interviews, but we have another bunch that haven't really been properly analyzed. We have the entire set of interviews with families and friends, which have yet to be analyzed. And so that is all in the works. I'm also probably heading off to Iraq to do some interviews there, and then hopefully doing some interviews with defectors with Al-Shabaab. And so lots of stuff in the works, but finding the time and the funds is the issue, as always.
Well, best of luck with that. We'll try to rope you back in here after your trip to Iraq. Amar, thank you so much for joining us on this podcast today.
Again, all links can be found in the show notes and on our website at www.njhomelandsecurity.gov. If you have any ideas or topics for future episodes, please contact us on Twitter at NJOHSP or email us at intelunclass@njohsp.gov. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to subscribe to Intelligence Unclassified.